This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio.
I'm Danny Wisentowski in for Elaine Shaw. A note first that this next conversation involves a discussion of abuse at a school, including sexual abuse and suicide. As we look back on this year of news in Missouri, there continues to be activity around Christian boarding schools, which until 2021 operated completely without regulation or oversight. Three schools, each facing abuse allegations, have now closed in the last few years, starting in 2020 with the Circle of Hope Girls Ranch. The closure of that school, located in southwest Missouri, followed dozens of abuse allegations, and in 2021, criminal charges were filed against its married founders, Boyd and Stephanie Householder. But the story of what's happening in Missouri's Christian boarding school industry and the closure of Circle of Hope didn't start with that criminal investigation. That story instead begins with TikTok, where the former residents of those schools, now adults, began posting their accounts of beatings, starvation, and worse. Those stories also came from Amanda Householder, the daughter of the school's founders. In one video, uploaded before the ranch's closure in 2020, she counted off examples on her fingers to describe the terrible things she had seen her parents do.
Growing up, you were not allowed to watch TV because it was considered evil and you'd burn in hell for eternity. You were not allowed to listen to the radio because it was considered evil and you'd burn in hell for eternity. If you were ever starved as a punishment, if you ever watched your father pick up a disabled child by the neck and slam her to the ground to restrain her, if you were ever told to restrain one of your peers, if you didn't, you would be restrained instead. If you ever watched your father force another child to eat their vomit, if your father runs a cult.
In March of 2021, Amanda Householder's father, Boyd Householder, was charged with 79 felony counts, including for sexually abusing a child. His wife, Stephanie Householder, also faced charges for child abuse. Earlier this summer, however, Boyd Householder died, leaving only his wife to face trial next year. Amanda Householder told me that her father's death isn't the same as getting justice. And earlier this week, I interviewed Amanda about her activism, the rise of a survivor community on places like TikTok, and what it was like living and working at the Circle of Hope Ranch, and what it was like watching it fall. I began by asking Amanda to describe her upbringing and the beliefs that her parents used to justify their abuse.
The only way I can explain it is when you're taught from a very young age that anything outside of this religion can make you go to hell, you don't want to see anyone you know go to hell. And so when you're taught that it's better to have a black bottom than a black soul, you kind of just think, okay, well, maybe I do deserve this because if I'm bad, I'm going to go to hell. So they're just teaching you how to get to heaven, not to go to hell. And so it really wasn't until I had my own kids that I realized that kids aren't bad. They aren't going to go to hell for learning life. You're supposed to learn. You're supposed to learn what's right from wrong, not right from wrong being beaten out of you.
I want to understand a bit of what being at the Circle of Hope boarding school was like. You actually worked there as a teenager, as a child. This was not a job that you sought out or applied for, if I'm understanding. What was it like to witness that? What did the kids do there every day, and what did you have to do as a staff member?
What we did there every day is really hard to go through because Boyd was very unpredictable. And so we rarely did school. School was rarely a thing. Cleaning, taking care of the animals, hard labor is the main thing that we did there. Or we sat down and read the Bible. I can tell you that even though I was raised in a very abusive household, it was really, really, really hard to see others get thrown to the ground. And it's called restraint. But they would get thrown to the ground and they would be screaming for hours and hours and hours and hours. And that was hell. I can't explain it other than that. I just remember if Boyd yelled restraint, we all had to come, like all of the higher up shirts. And I remember, I can't tell you exactly when, but I could, not too long after they implemented that we were the ones having to do the restraints, us teenagers, I would stay back in the kitchen and be like, oh, I have to get this done, or, oh, I have to, I would make excuses not to go. But that didn't matter because you could still hear the screaming and the crying and the pain that they were going through. The best way to explain what it was like being there is the moment you woke up, you realized you were in the place that you wanted to escape.
So there comes a point, though, and I think this is, again, when you are a teenager and very young, that you do recognize something is not right here, and the way that you're being treated and the way that the other kids are being treated is wrong. What was it that opened your eyes, and what did you do after that?
So it really wasn't until I had my own kids, I was 21, that I really realized that no kid is an evil kid. But there was something inside of me growing up that didn't want to be with my parents. Like, it was hell living there. I would wake up, I would be miserable. I first attempted suicide when I was 10. But I can't say that I definitely knew something was wrong. I just knew that I did not want to be with my parents. I did run away at Circle of Hope, not too long after they opened. I want to say it was like August, and they opened in like June. I ran away with two of the girls, and the reason I ran away was because one of the girls came to me, and she had told me that my dad was touching her inappropriately, and she's like, my stepdad did this to me, and I can't go through this again. And so we bagged up all my stuff, and me and two girls left that uni. I did go out, and I hugged my dad, and I said goodnight, and I hugged my mom, and then I hugged my little brother. And then we went back to our rooms, and then that night we left. We ran away. But there was still, I got sent back to Circle of Hope, and it was beaten into me that what I did was wrong. And so there was still something in me that felt like I was a bad person. But it wasn't until I had my kids that I was like, I would never, ever, my parents beat me as a baby for crying. Babies cry. When my son would cry and I couldn't figure out why he would cry, the only thing I wanted to do was hold him. I didn't look at him and think, oh, you're evil, you're lying to me, you're this, you're that. But that's what my parents would think. And it was the weirdest thing to hold a baby and realize that my parents were messed up, because I could never do that to my kid.
You were working at the Circle of Hope as a staff member. How did you become, you know, one of the so-called troubled teens that it was helping?
Well, that's the thing. I never was necessarily considered a troubled teen like the school was helping. When I ran away, I did get sent back and put into a orange shirt. But one thing that you learn when you are raised in this and you don't want to be hurt, you learn to lie. And I lied, and I said I got saved, and so I was taken out of that orange shirt. I wasn't in Circle of Hope's program. I was just a child that was raised like that, if that makes sense. But I was never considered a troubled teen. My parents did threaten to send me away, but I never got sent away, and that was because I learned how to manipulate and say, no, Jesus saved me. Jesus this, Jesus that.
You mentioned an orange shirt. What did that signify?
So the shirt, it's a shirt system, and it changed a lot. But from what I remember was orange was when you were a new kid. Yellow was when you were there for a little bit longer. And then it went like green, purple, and red. Red was the highest shirt, which would be junior staff. My parents did not have when they first opened, they did not have staff. And so myself and the older girls that were considered junior staff, we were considered staff. And that's how I became a staff. I wasn't really staff. I was like a junior staff. The shirt system was another way of controlling. They did add on to that. Like before I left, they added a black shirt. Black was considered thin. If you wore black, you were a sinner. And so that is the color that they gave the worst, in their opinion, the worst students. But you literally could be put in a black shirt for anything. My mom would get it in her head that she didn't like a girl, and she would sit there and do everything in her power to make that girl have a mental breakdown to the point that my dad would put her in a black shirt. And so I was staff, but I was never technically an adult staff. I was a junior staff.
One of the things that is just really stunning about this entire story is that this was ostensibly a school, you know, to correct behavior and spiritual problems, but it was supposed to be a school. It was totally unregulated by the state of Missouri, had no rules. Did this feel like a school to you? Were you getting an education in some way, or was this all about the other things?
No, it did not feel like a school. My main education was on how to be art. I should say art, not just mine. It was the girls within the program as well. Our main education was how to be a housewife. Very rarely did we sit down and do the curriculum that they chose, which was called ACE, Accelerated Christian Education. But when I was in it and the girls were in it, it was not a good school. A lot of it was Bible, history. Math was a joke. Science was a joke. But the majority of our schooling was how to be a wife.
We're talking about the state of Christian boarding schools in Missouri, and I'm talking today with Amanda Householder, a survivor of the now-closed Circle of Hope boarding school and the daughter of its founders, Boyd and Stephanie Householder. What was it that finally allowed you to break things off with your parents and get away?
So the youngest child my parents ever took in was a 5-year-old. And she wasn't put in the dorms at first. She was put in my room. And so it was me and this little 5-year-old, and we bonded. But my mom could not stand her. One night, I forget why, but they moved her up into the dorms with the other girls. And we had just gotten done with Bible study, or devotions is what they called it. And I walked downstairs because we were all at the end doing our Bible reading again before we go to bed. And she was crying. And I asked her why she was crying. And she said that she didn't want her mom to go to hell, because the devotions we just had, my dad had said that if you are a female and you wear pants, you're going to hell. And I looked at her and I said, honey, I was like, if your mom is going to hell for wearing pants, my sister's in hell and my dad's mom is in hell and my aunt is in hell. They all died in a car crash, but they all wore pants. And somehow that got back to my parents, and that was a last straw. And they kicked me out.
So my understanding, you know, with this case, there were many, many complaints, legal complaints, complaints to the local sheriff's department, complaints to the various state departments over the years in that Circle of Hope was open. But things really don't start happening until closer to 2020. And that's when you were also getting on TikTok and sharing your story. What were the elements that really came together to finally turn the attention of the authorities to your parents in a way that it hadn't before?
So in 2018, we had this deputy that was not a highway patrol officer he was not connected to Cedar County, which is the county Circle of Hope was in. And he did an investigation and he took it to a prosecuting attorney outside of Cedar County, and they declined prosecuting because it wasn't their jurisdiction. And so the reason we went to this Highway Patrol officer is because for years, since the opening of Circle of Hope, people would call Cedar County and Cedar County would be like, oh, that's not our jurisdiction, called Polk County, which is Humansville, but which Circle of Hope is in Humansville, but it's on the Cedar County side. So for years, we were getting, nope, not our problem, to the point that a mother went through 11 different ways of filing charges. She contacted the post office because Boyd would open up the girl's presents and not give the student themselves the present, but everyone else. So she tried getting those charges put on Circle of Hope, but that didn't even happen. So we knew that something was up, and it took us going to TikTok finally to have one deputy within that Cedar County Sheriff's Department reach out and say, hey, there's a couple of people within this office that want to do something, but we haven't been able to. And he confided in me basically saying, when we started getting things going, and that was only because of TikTok, because we got hundreds of people calling that prosecuting attorney, hundreds of people calling that sheriff's department, that they finally were like, oh, well, we have to do something. But it was because of corruption that nothing got done. And it was because of corruption that it took us going to TikTok and reliving our trauma for anything to get done.
When you did go to TikTok and you told your story, what was the reaction that you got? Was it what you were expecting?
No, not at all what I was expecting. I was expecting to be told, like we had been told millions of times, it was our fault. But no, it was a bunch of teenagers sitting there saying, oh my God, that could happen to me. Oh my God. And so we got a lot of support, and I sat there and cried because we, for so many years, have been told we were liars. Just to have thousands, like almost 300,000 people say, no, we believe you. It was amazing. It really was.
The trial for your parents, that was supposed to happen by now already.
It was supposed to happen twice already.
It was supposed to happen twice already, but your father died. This summer, the trial for your mother, Stephanie Householder, is now scheduled, I understand, for September of next year. What has it been like to wait for these multiple trials, but also to get a kind of closure, at least for someone who committed so much harm, as you've described it?
I'm going to say this because I'm really sad that my dad died. I really am. But at the same time, I'm really mad he died, because we deserved to see him in court. We deserved to at least force him to see everything he's done. And that doesn't mean he would actually repent, or not even repent. It doesn't mean he would be remorseful or anything like that. But we deserved that.
I'm curious of your thoughts on this upcoming trial, and if this is something that could potentially do more to push the truth out, to resolve things, to give survivors like you closure, or is this just another reflection of how far Missouri has kicked this down the line?
I have no faith in Missouri at this time. I want to keep hope, and I want to say that this is going to be a way of closure. But I have a feeling that Missouri is going to make it more trauma for us, because that's what they have done to us these past, since 2020, 4 years. 4 years we've not been out here screaming what has happened to us and that there's other places like this, and they don't care. How was Julio Sandoval able to go from working at Agape and being investigated? His name is on one of the ones that was going to be charged a low misdemeanor. How was he able to go from Agape to Lighthouse Ministries after we put a law in place in 2021 that was supposed to do background checks? They're not even enforcing the law that we worked so hard to get. So I don't have any faith that Missouri is going to do the right thing. I really feel they did this to make them look good and now are trying their hardest to make it go away. And a lot of us are defeated. A lot, like I said, my physical health has gone down this year so much. I can't even get out of bed half the times because my stomach doesn't work the way it should. And that's because of the trauma, and not just the trauma I went through with Circle of Hope. It's the trauma that Missouri is re-putting us through. The fact that I have to wake up and find out more students are running away from the abuse we went through, that we were working so hard to end, that it's sickening. But where I'm at now is we may not have gotten the justice we deserved, but we have found family along the way. And if it weren't for my survivor friends, I think I would be doing a lot worse than I am right now. As much as they tried, and when I say they, I mean Agape and Circle of Hope, they tried to keep us from talking after the fact. They didn't want us to contact each other outside of this, but Facebook happened. They never expected Facebook to happen, and we became like family. If someone hits me up and they need help, I will help them, and the same with me. And that is, I think I need to focus more on that than the fact that we didn't get justice. One thing I do want to say is they offered Stephanie a plea deal, and I am worried that they are going to try to give Stephanie a lighter sentence. One thing I think people need to understand is Stephanie was just as bad as Boyd and does not deserve a lighter sentence. She may not have physically abused the students to the extent Boyd did, but she made it to where he did the abusing. Because, if, like I said earlier, she did not like a student, she would do everything in her power to make them mess up for Boyd to do something. And I hope Missouri sees that, yes, Boyd is dead, but the abuser, we have another abuser still alive, and we deserve justice that way as well.
That was Amanda Householder. She has spent the last several years talking about her experience at the Circle of Hope Girls Ranch, a Christian boarding school founded by her parents. Amanda's mother, Stephanie Householder, is expected to face trial on child abuse charges next year. Coming up, we continue our look at the status of Christian boarding schools in Missouri, and we'll meet a longtime activist against abuse in the Catholic Church and why he believes Missouri needs to do more to protect children. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Welcome back. I'm Danny Wisentowski. We're looking at the developments in Missouri's troubled Christian boarding school industry. Alongside survivors like Amanda Householder, who we got to meet earlier in the show, the cause has been joined by another notable activist, David Clossie. He is the former national director of SNAP, the survivors network of those abused by priests. This week, I sat down with David Clossie to talk about the work of survivors like Amanda Householder and why he maintains that Missouri officials like Attorney General Andrew Bailey still aren't doing enough to protect children. So, David, your November 20th op-ed in the Missouri Independent, it's titled, "It's Past Time for Missouri's Attorney General to Take Action Against Abusive Boarding Schools." You have been involved in advocating about abuse in churches in many different sectors for decades. But boarding schools is something that I think is kind of new. How did you get involved in this issue to the point that it brought you to being part of these demonstrations this summer?
Well, it started nearly a year ago. I'd heard and read, you know, some isolated stories here and there, but I saw a news account of five boys down in Piedmont, Missouri, out in the boondocks, who in the dead of winter ran away from one of these facilities. And I grew up in small town Missouri, and I had a sense of just how remote this place was. And I know that the overwhelming majority of kids who are sent to these Christian boarding schools come from out of state. So these were kids, 12, 13, 14-year-olds, who knew no one, but who were being so severely mistreated that in the dead of night, in the cold, they took off running. And I realized that, you know, this is a problem that's deeper than, you know, many of us, myself included, realized. So I went down there and simply handed out flyers for a couple of hours. And, you know, sure enough, I began hearing at first from neighbors and others who saw or heard about what happened there, and then eventually from victims. And it kind of has spiraled since then.
One of the big developments that's happened this year and in recent history is those former students. You stood side by side with folks like Amanda Householder, who were sharing their stories, who did things that were very similar to what you faced in the early 2000s as you drew attention toward the bishops and churches. What was your impression of this new generation? You know, again, kids who had survived something incredibly terrible and were standing with you.
Yeah. I was, and I continue to be, just in awe of people like Amanda and these other brave kids. They're not kids now. They're mostly, you know, in their 20s or some in their 30s. But they are among some of the most courageous. I shouldn't rank survivors and how they cope with their pain and recover, but these kids are incredibly brave and incredibly resilient. And it's important to remember that they were already they had already gotten the short end of the stick being sent to these homes. In other words, a fundamentalist mom or dad realized that their 13-year-old daughter Sally was hanging around with another kid who was known to be gay, or their 15-year-old son Billy was caught drinking beer at a couple of parties. And these parents, frankly, in my view, overreacted. They thought, oh my gosh, the kid's going off the rails. I've got to do something dramatic. So these kids already were deeply damaged when they went to these facilities.
I want to ask about kind of the level of activity around this issue in just the last few years. There have been three of these boarding schools that have closed. Is it surprising how rapidly these developments have occurred when you spent many, many years watching, you know, the Catholic Church or others really rebuff and move people around and find ways to keep these places open? What do you account for the quickness of these closings?
Well, in many ways, Danny, it doesn't feel quick because I hear, you know, these horrific experiences that oftentimes do date back 10 or 15 or 20 years. And I hear about not just kids, but parents and some former staff who have knocked on the door of law enforcement for years without any real response. But any and all progress, I think, is really simply due to the tenacity of these young people because, you know, that's the only way when victims speak up. Sad to say, that really seems to be the only way in which officials really take notice and begin belatedly and grudgingly to finally take action.
What do you make of the fact that Missouri has created some new laws? I believe it was in 2021. This was after a lot of reporting from the Kansas City Star and, of course, a lot of what the survivors like Amanda Householder, you know, making their voices heard. These boarding schools were not regulated as schools or as anything, it seems. The new law sets minimum health and safety standards. It mandates some background checks, requires adequate food and clothing and medical care. Again, it's shocking that that wasn't required. It says parents must be allowed to access their children at any time. Given what you've said, you know, is that progress? Is that a very small first step?
It is progress, and it's a small first step only if it's enforced. And you have to remember, these are relatively small facilities. They're way out in remote areas. And the state, so far, state officials have done an incredibly minimal job when they do intervene after getting reports of abuse. And this is a horrific betrayal of not just the students, but their parents, who were paying good money to send them here to hopefully, you know, get their lives back on track. So I think there's been very little real action by state officials. And there's been only this one very recent law that has set forward, like you said, the bare minimum standards, like passing fire code, right, and making sure that kids are given the prescription medicine that their doctors have ordered. But there's a long, long way to go.
One of the other notable differences about the case of these boarding schools and what you experienced with priests in the Catholic Church is the presence of social media and TikTok. And Amanda Householder, when she was finally at a place to tell her story, she had hundreds of thousands of people who watched her videos. And then, as she told me, hundreds of those people called the different sheriffs and police departments and created some of that pressure that really seems to explain why things really have accelerated in the last couple of years. What does that look like to you to see that kind, that new kind of public response that, that you did not have when you were talking about this in the early 2000s and the 90s?
Yeah. Oh, it's very, very encouraging. It was a real turning point for those of us abused in the Catholic Church when the internet arrived. And we could, lacking the ability to draw attention from the mainstream media, many of us turned to the internet. And now, fast forward a couple of decades, and as you mentioned, there's TikTok and, you know, other forms of social media that were just simply not around. It's very encouraging. It's very validating. It's very empowering. And again, it takes incredible courage for these kids to lay bare their souls and their suffering just out there for anybody and everybody to see. But it can be a tool that enables them to organize collectively and finally bring about, you know, some degree of healing. And if nothing else, what they're doing is they're doing what we've asked the Attorney General to do, which is they're warning parents who are thinking about sending kids to these facilities to, you know, think twice and to investigate thoroughly. Because lacking any state oversight or any real licensing requirements, these parents they're flying blind.
You know, we started this conversation talking about your op-ed for the Missouri Independent last month, and you were calling on the Missouri Attorney General, Andrew Bailey, to do more. The Associated Press wrote about this. Andrew Bailey gave a response basically to, you know, I think to what you and the other survivors have been talking about, saying that the Missouri Attorney General's office does not have original jurisdiction to prosecute criminal cases, including those of sexual abuse and trafficking. What do you make of that response, that this isn't the Attorney General's jurisdiction, that this has to be, I guess, starting at the local prosecutor level? What do you make of that?
You know, that's incredibly depressing, hair-splitting. We've asked the Attorney General to do half a dozen things, almost all of which he clearly has the authority to do. For example, we've said, okay, let's give you the benefit of the doubt and claim that you can't act without county prosecutors acting first. Well, use your bully pulpit right to those county prosecutors and tell them, look, here's what we've seen just in the mainstream media, just in the civil courts, just in the criminal courts. Here's what we've seen. Some of this may be happening in your jurisdiction. Get busy, start investigating, and the AG's office will help. Just simply a letter. We've asked the Attorney General to simply hold a Zoom phone call with some of these victims so that they can feel like the state of Missouri is attuned to, you know, their suffering. We've asked him to try to broker a deal with these facilities owners to let some independent nonprofit that focuses on children's well-being to go in and investigate or inspect these schools, you know, on a regular basis. We've asked him to do all of these things that he does not need any additional statutory power to do. And I guess I would turn it around and say, you know, if a public servant really wants to address a serious problem and believes he or she doesn't have the legal authority to do it, well, they do one of two things. They either lobby another public official, in this case it would be the governor, who does have the power to start acting, or would go to the state legislature and say, I'm in charge of this arena. We've got this serious problem. I don't have the legal tools to deal with it, give me more power. And Bailey's done neither of those things. So, and finally, you know, we've also asked him to simply do what we're trying to do, which is ring the alarm bell and say to parents, we've got dozens of these schools. We don't know enough about them. Some are legit, some are not. So please, 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 if you're thinking about sending your kid to a private fundamentalist, you know, boarding school, Christian boarding school, work hard and do your due diligence, because not all of these places are what they claim to be.
One of the variables here is time. That is happening in this case. Boyd Householder, the father of Amanda Householder, who we heard from before, he was supposed to go to trial, I think, just this year. He was facing 22 counts of very, very serious crimes against children. He died in June. He will never face those charges. Is that part of the danger here of allowing this time to unfold?
It is. But I would argue that, yes, with the passage of time and inaction by law enforcement and state officials, yes, more predators and sadists who hurt kids at these facilities will escape any accountability. But there's an even greater problem, and that is that without pursuing these wrongdoers, kids today are being abused or at risk of horrific abuse in these schools right now. So it's not just a case where we've got to take, you know, in some way remedy past harm. We got to stop harm right now. I mean, you cannot tell me that, well, no, I shouldn't say that. Let me just, it's possible, in fact, it's likely that some of these boarding schools are now being a little bit more careful about who they hire, and a little bit more prompt about acting on abuse reports. But we all know that, you know, the way you prevent crimes is by pursuing the criminals. These places are under the radar. They're accountable to virtually no one. They're inspected by almost no one. And unless and until some of these owners and operators who either abuse or let abuse happen, until some of those people are behind bars, there's not going to be any real incentive for the other school staff to, you know, shape up and fly right. There's just not.
That was David Clossie, the former national director of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. He spoke with me earlier this week about abuse in Missouri's Christian boarding schools.
This episode was produced by Danny Wisentowski.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.